Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Until this last Tuesday, we seemed to be running on empty. But we just refueled our visions with some of that new clean energy that everyone's talking about, and things are looking brighter already. And no one says it better than the League of Conservation Voters, who list their dirty dozen enemies of the environment to delist them from the rolls of Congress. This was a near clean sweep of the corruptors, and we find out why when the Wild Side News continues. Well, election 2006 is finally over, and I must say my brain is trying to readjust, because it seemed for quite some time there that the future had one sort of glide path, and now it seems as if there's another. As everybody knows, the election came out with quite a shift in power, as many more Democrats replaced Republicans, and therefore there is now a majority in the House, and we're trying to determine what's happening in the Senate, and it may take some time for that to sort out. There's many stories to be told about this particular election and what it may mean, and joining us now to help really interpret that is Chuck Porcari, who is the Director of Communications for the League of Conservation Voters. Chuck, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be here.
First of all, for people who may not be familiar with the League of Conservation Voters, what is it that you hope to accomplish?
The League of Conservation Voters is, the short version is, we're the political arm of the environmental movement. We run campaigns and support candidates across the country at the congressional level who support the environment. We are a 36-year-old organization, and that is our primary mission, and our secondary mission involves scoring sitting Congress members of Congress on Capitol Hill per their environmental voting records. Every year we put out the National Environmental Scorecard, which is seen on Capitol Hill as chapter and verse on individual members' voting record.
What's interesting about that is the fact that you then rank these people, or you at least evaluate them, and you have some friends, many of whom you endorse, and as well you're prepared to define those people who you consider to be not friends of the environment, perhaps even anti-environment. And what I find very interesting about the outcome of this particular election, and there's a lot to be learned from looking at the League of Conservation Voters and those who you supported and you didn't, this particular election cycle, you had identified what were referred to as the Dirty Dozen. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about them, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, the Dirty Dozen is a long-standing league activity, which is where we identify the 12, maybe sometimes the 13. This year it was actually 15, and I'll get into that in a moment, members of Congress with some of the worst environmental records. We actually use the Dirty Dozen as an impetus to run campaigns against these individuals. We have a success rate of just over 50% as far as removing them from office. And these are the individuals who consistently vote against environmental matters, whether it be air, land, water, or whatever the legislation may be. This year was very interesting. In 2006, we actually had the Dirty 15 because, interestingly enough, we had Bob Ney and Tom DeLay on the list, which we had to then remove because they left office, and add a couple more. So it was just that was one of the, as you said, some very interesting twists this year. But we had a great campaign. We were able to work in concert with some other groups, and we were able to help the voters of the California's 11th District defeat Richard Pombo, who is arguably the most anti-environmental member of Congress that was up for election this year. And we're very pleased with that result. And we're very pleased with the results overall, and in a nonpartisan sense, too, because we also ran campaigns on behalf of environmentally friendly Republican members also.
But here's what I find very interesting about this particular election. Now, in years past, in previous elections, in terms of the Dirty Dozen, you mentioned that your success rate is about 50%, but has it been more difficult over the last number of years because of this sort of consolidation of power within the Republican Party, in the sense of trying to defeat them, that was difficult to defeat them?
There's no question. And what we saw in the last several political cycles is a Republican Party unlike the Republican Party that this organization has been used to supporting for years. You know, being the independent voice, political voice of the environment, you know, for many years we supported candidates and sitting members with the Republican Party, you know, in the Roosevelt-Rockefeller tradition, if you may. So what we saw this cycle is, and over the last several years, is that a brand of Republicanism that we're that we hadn't seen before, and that the country hasn't seen before. This is a brand that is was wholly under the influence of big oil dollars. This is a brand that was wholly under the influence of various special interests, moving farther and farther away from the traditional Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt Republican environmental ethos. So it's kind of it's been kind of a different animal over the last several years. Last night, you can argue, was the first step in the move back towards a more moderate, a more pragmatic, and a more responsible Republican Party.
Of the Dirty 15, and we'll take two out, okay, because they couldn't run.
Exactly.
For other dirty reasons. But of the remaining 13, mm-hmm. how many actually were defeated?
Well, we had a great success, and albeit it took a little more time than we thought, but we were able to defeat Conrad Burns in Montana. We were able to defeat Jim Talent, sitting senator in Missouri, a terrible environmental record. Catherine Harris in Florida, Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania. We had Heather Wilson in New Mexico, and actually, as we speak and hold this interview, that is actually still. That race hasn't been called yet in the first district of New Mexico. It's literally an hour-by-hour thing, from
correct.
What I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So we have had great success this year, and we're one of those situations. We had added Deborah Price from Ohio, and, you know, so generally we were very successful, and for a lot of reasons, mostly because I would argue that these particular candidates, their vision of our energy future didn't equate with the American people's version of the energy future. You know, the American people's vision of our energy future is very different from what the current policies are. And, well, you know, big oil was certainly the big loser here. We think ultimately what we learned per the Dirty Dozen and per our other electoral efforts this cycle was that the voters, you know, are usually way ahead of Washington, and they proved it again last night.
As I look through the list of candidates who you endorsed, I'm also taken by the fact that of those who were endorsed, of which, I don't know, there must be about 80 or 90, I think,
yeah.
about 10 were not reelected or elected. That's an astonishing correlation between support for the environment and the capacity to serve in the House or the Senate. What's your take on that?
Well, what we found, and we did some very extensive polling over the last year, and it's fascinating. Energy independence and the creation of a new energy economy, we found, was the singular domestic issue that cut across partisan, geographic, and demographic lines. So we found the candidates that didn't cue or didn't support or didn't see or have this particular vision of a new energy economy we had a very difficult time last night. And the lesson there is, we would argue that, you know, Americans want less dependence on oil, and they would rather depend on American ingenuity, the American work ethic, to create, you know, these new clean energy products and jobs. And we're not just talking lab coat kind of jobs. We're talking manufacturing, marketing, shipping, et cetera. So there is America is ready for this new energy economy, you know, based on clean and renewable sources, and candidates that didn't reflect that value had a lot of trouble last night.
And I think, you know, there's some things that we just can't prove in politics, and one of those is that there was or there was not a correlation between the invasion of Iraq and our need for oil. But I do believe that, primarily the political spinmeisters right now are saying that it was the war, stupid, it was the war. But I tend to believe, and I want to believe, and I do believe, that in reality Americans were able to look at that issue and say, yes, and so why don't we therefore eliminate that need and the potential that in the future here we're just going to continue down this path and go ahead and get busy and create our energy independence? I think they made that shift in their own mind.
I would absolutely agree. And you know, you can't take away, obviously, the war being the dominant issue of the cycle, and it's there, and that will always be there. But the side issues, the spin-off issues of it, the dependence issue, the idea that that we're importing half of our oil, of course, it raised kind of the consciousness of our challenges there. But I would also argue, too, it was a combination of other things. Hurricane Katrina, in one fell swoop, wiped out 25% of our refining capacity on a temporary basis. So prices shot up. It come down somewhat, but still, you would argue that gas prices had a large role in this cycle. So you're saying that it's very difficult to say it was either X or Y or Z that was responsible for what happened last night. Certainly, was intermingling of the issues in many ways, and obviously energy independence and, you know, what is happening overseas. You know, there is a natural relationship to that, and you know the voters are smart; they understand this, and maybe, you know, the consultants and some of the politicians should give them a little more credit.
To what degree do you think what's happening on public lands throughout the West, the mountaintop removal for coal, and those types of backyard issues factor into the decisions as well by voters this election?
Significant. In one word, significant. It's very interesting, and this is something that's been evolving under the radar for several years, but kind of manifested itself in this cycle. And this is the fact that, you know, those who consider themselves outdoors members of the outdoors community, hunters, fishermen, etc., those that consider themselves conservationists, environmentalists, whatever. The fact is that there's been an increasing recognition that, you know, their ends are all the same. The means may be different in some cases, but their ends are the same. And public lands is a big part of it, whether it be for access, whether it be for preservation. But the fact that over the last several years we've had to fight tooth and nail on Capitol Hill to keep the Congress from allowing the wholesale sell-off of public lands for resource extraction and things of that nature, you know, it's brought the communities together, and we're looking at each other saying, you know, where we may have had a wary eye before, the community saying, well, wait a minute, we all want the same thing here. And that is becoming a very powerful force out west. You know, when you have a editorial in Field and Stream saying that the League of Conservation Voter Scorecard is probably the thing that their community and their readership should look at to gauge an environmental ethic, then you know you're getting somewhere. And that's what happened this year.
That's interesting, because I also heard that there were all these micro pollings that were going on and targeting voters. And one of the criteria for defining someone who was considered a conservative by Karl Rove, et cetera, was whether or not they subscribed to Field and Stream. So they may have shot themselves in the foot on that one. And there's a whole new look as well to conservationists and environmentalists and even liberalism. For example, John Tester is a wonderful example of a success story, which we're happy to announce. He's a great guy. I like John Tester.
He is. And we see Senator-elect Tester as the star of this new Senate class. He is genuine and as down-to-earth and as pragmatic as an individual as you'll ever meet. I've been fortunate enough to spend some time with him. And this individual is the real deal, and he's been on the land his entire life. He knows our issues. He knows a lot of issues inside and out, and we think he is going to be the star of this class.
Well, it really is a re-embracing of what America is about, as far as I'm concerned, and it's well overdue. And just one other thing, because I know we have a limited time here, in terms of committee changes, if assuming, for example, now we're definitely going to take over the House, we don't exactly know what the status of the Senate is, but in terms, you know, the majority party has quite a bit of power in terms of committee assignments. Are there any of these that we should pay particular attention to in the months ahead?
Well, in all honesty, we're not too excited about playing what ifs or who should be is. But what we are saying is that the electorate has been very clear about their wants and desires in this cycle, and we obviously want a chair of the Natural Resources Committee that isn't interested in selling national parks, that isn't interested in selling public lands for mineral extraction on a massive scale. That isn't interested in taking their family on an RV trip at the taxpayers' expense to visit national parks. So whomever that individual may be, they have the opinion of the electorate firmly in their back pocket. So, you know, there are a lot of issues we're going to be working on. There's a lot of exciting possibilities. And whomever may occupy those key chairs, whether it be Resources Committee, whether it be Commerce or others, we're looking forward to working with them on behalf of our constituents.
And finally, what are some of the dreams for the next couple of years here from the League of Conservation Voters with this new mix in the House and Senate?
Well, we're actually looking forward, and we have a we're starting a global warming project. It's very interesting because we talked about committees earlier. We are looking forward to science based hearings instead of science fiction based hearings on the issue. We will be going into all the early primary states in 2008 and elevating the issue so it becomes a part of the discussion of the presidential cycle. This is a nonpartisan, but you know, we certainly want both parties talking about it, and we're doing that as we speak. We're obviously looking forward towards legislation that takes away the subsidies to big oil and reinvests our resources in clean and renewable energy, move ourselves towards energy independence. We obviously know it's going to be a long road. It's going to be a challenging road, but it's time to take the way past time that we took those first steps.
Chuck Porcari, if people want to find out more about the League of Conservation Voters, give them a website.
Absolutely. Please, for more information, just visit us on our website at www.lcv.org.
Chuck Porcari, Communications Director for the League of Conservation Voters, thanks for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
And so the American legacy continues. And despite our recurring setbacks, we can be proud to know that when we are pushed, we come together as we should as Americans. This whole ongoing saga goes back a long time to an earlier America and some very rustic first Americans. You'll learn about our ancestors and their struggles to set up a free nation when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.